This podcast is brought to you by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and International Wildlife Crime Stoppers. Listen to the Thin Green Line podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Game wardens John Norris and Wayne Saunders talk about wildlife, the outdoors, law enforcement, environmental subjects mixed with current events and guests that are part of the Thin Green Line. And if you are one of those visual people like me, for $5 a month, you can see the actual podcast on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com and join us.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. On this Memorial Podcast Week, I would like to welcome a new advertiser, Sovereign Sportsman Solution. And when I told their representative, Ben Page, that I would be starting their ads on the Memorial Podcast Week, Ben said to me, he said, Sovereign Sportsman Solutions would be honored to start on your Memorial Podcast. So this podcast is brought to you by, in part, Sovereign Sportsman Solution. As conservation officers, we know just how important technology is in this day and age. S3 is a cutting-edge and trusted vendor that provides state agencies with licensing, mobile, CRM, marketing, law enforcement, and event management solutions, all in one place. They are dedicated to benefiting the resource, so check out the link in the show notes to sign up for their newsletter and get industry's insights, news, content, and keep you up to date with the tech that drives conservation into the future. Welcome to episode 59 of Warden's Watch for the Fallen. This episode is released on a Monday that starts off our Memorial Police Officer Week, which honors our fallen, whether you're a game warden, whether you're a law enforcement officer, park ranger, police officer, metro officer, any law enforcement that's been killed in the line of duty. And I think it's really special that we honor these people that have given that ultimate sacrifice, John, especially during the turmoil that's going on across our country, that we remember the guys that gave that ultimate sacrifice, you know, for whether it's for their brother, for their country, for their environment, for the resource, because we're going to hear stories about those guys too. So it really hits home. We got a special guest here to kind of introduce this and start off, and then we're going to roll into a Vermont game warden that was killed in the line of duty 43 years ago, and we have a special guest as well to speak on that section. So because we want to remember all of them, whether it's long time ago, or whether it was just a few years ago, we want to remember these officers. So important, isn't it, John?
Yeah, Wayne, you hit it on the head when you talk about, I mean, this week coming up is heavy for all of us because you guys in New Hampshire, me coming from California, I think about the game wardens I know and work with in my new home state of Montana, and just all of us on the Thin Green Line, but more importantly, all of us on the first responder law enforcement sheepdog line. we have so many stories that you and myself and our special guest come that you're going to introduce here in a minute have being in the Thin Green Line of conservation officers and officers we've lost either that we knew personally, that we worked with closely, or that we know through the brotherhood from other states. But especially now, the turmoil that the country's in right now, the number of officer deaths that are just so senseless in some of these riots and these, the civil unrest we have going on the political front through COVID, it's heartbreaking. And it's another testament to what we do as men and women when we put on that badge, kind of a selfless sacrifice, if you will, especially when, unfortunately, law enforcement is viewed in such a negative light right now under a stereotype, however erroneous or not, and what our officers are doing nationwide and the sacrifices they're making and the deaths that are occurring because of it. It's a terrible, challenging time. We're not backing down. And this week is special that we honor the fallen and we respect the badge of everybody out there doing it for the sake of the community.
And I really couldn't think of a better guest to bring in on this conversation, John, than my own former colonel, Kevin Jordan, because he is the president of the New Hampshire Law Enforcement Memorial Association, which is something very unique that I've never seen before across the country, where game wardens actually, you know, our presidents are very involved with their law enforcement memorial. And certainly he has some history. He knows some of those names personally on that wall. And I'm going to let him to speak to that. Certainly happy, Colonel Jordan, that you could join us for this week. And I know every law enforcement memorial you usually do a speech. The governor usually introduces you. And COVID certainly has taken that away for last year, and it sounds like this year as well. So, but thank you for joining us. And if you could talk about the law enforcement memorial, your role, and anything else you want to talk about, Colonel.
Absolutely. So all good points, John. Well said. You're right. This is a week that I don't want to say I look forward to, but I certainly look at this week wearing a badge different than I do any other week, because I think it is a time to look back at some of those guys and gals that made the ultimate sacrifice doing what we're doing every day. And we're not real good in this profession on singing our own praises. So I think that those kind of sacrifices get lost in the shuffle of today. I also get concerned, and I don't want to get into politics of today, but I get concerned when I'm watching the news like everyone is, and you see a lot of the negativity that's coming out. A lot of, I got to tell you, a young police officer watching the news today is thinking to himself, if he's honest, he's thinking to himself, boy, I got to be real sure when I pull this gun out, if I'm ever put in that position, that I'm doing the right thing at the right moment. And to be honest with you, that's very dangerous. That's how we lose good police officers, because if you take that 2 seconds extra on top of what we know from all the years of training the three of us have had to second guess yourself, that may be too late. And that's concerning when I've got a field force half full of young officers who I'm sure are looking at things that way. So this is a good opportunity this week to let the public know quietly, respectfully, not quietly, but respectfully, that there are guys out there that are doing this, and guys and gals that are doing this absolutely correct. There are people out there who have made ultimate sacrifices and deserve, and their families deserve, the recognition that they've earned, certainly. So yes, we in New Hampshire, we normally this week have, or May 14th, the week of May 14th, Police Week, we put on a really good service, I think. We've done it for years. We have the governor there, the attorney general's there. We read our roll of honor. In New Hampshire, our roll of honor consists of 51 names of officers who have made the ultimate sacrifice. We have five from the 1800s. The balance of those are from this century. Wayne is right. Unfortunately, the longer you're in this business, the more of those names you know, and that whole second wall are all people that I knew, some that Wayne and I even worked with. And there are two names on that wall that were in the same shooting that almost took Wayne's life, the shooting that we were all in 1997. So where Wayne was severely wounded and fortunately survived. So all of that has a special place for me, based on experience and what these guys deserve. And so I've always considered it an honor to be on this. How Fish and Game ended up on the New Hampshire one is a little unique. We had a major, Tim Aserno, who's still one of my board members. He had a brother-in-law who was a state trooper who was tragically killed a number of years ago. His family, the family of this fallen trooper, really was the initial driving force to create the Memorial Association in New Hampshire and build a monument. And so he started that way back years ago. As I came up in the ranks here, for whatever reason, the major decided that I should be on that panel. I think he knew how I felt. You know, I was very patriotic and I had strong beliefs about officers and their sacrifices. So he asked me to join the board, and I jumped at that opportunity, and I've been on it ever since. And I would later become the president of it, and I'm not going to give it up unless I die or get so old I can't stand up there any longer, because it means a great deal to me. Not that there aren't others that can do it, because I'm very fortunate. I have a board like any organization. We've got, you know, a big board, but you got 10 movers and shakers. So I have 10 of the finest police officers you could ever ask for that support this, and they're troopers, they're sheriffs, they're local police, they're city police. And it just makes a great combination. So this year we cannot do the ceremony. I say we cannot. We decided not to. You have to pull the trigger on that a little early to get everything set up for it. And in April, which was really at the last moment, we decided, you know, we just don't want to get some of our survivors are some of the most vulnerable population. I just didn't want to run the risk of making them sick. They've suffered enough. So we are going to do a virtual one for the first time. So it'll be filmed and shown on YouTube live as we do it. I'm going to have just the committee members there. We're going to do kind of a smaller version of it. Yep. With a couple of prayers and some taps, a gun salute. We're certainly going to call the roll of honor and put flowers in for every name, which I think is important to the family. So they'll be able to sit home in the safety of their home and watch it. And then next year, by God, we'll be back on the monument and putting on the ceremony they all deserve. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I think I guard it passionately, quite frankly. I'm very active with the families and the survivor groups. I want them treated with respect and dignity, and I want them happy with how we do things. So we have them very involved. I have family members that are on my committee, survivors. So we get a survivor's point of view of what we do. It's probably without question the most challenging group that I work with, because there are, as you can imagine, there are some very passionate people about how things occurred, what's happened since. I'm not gonna lie to you, there's some bitterness with some families. I get that. At some point, you're gonna be angry about the loss of a loved one. I would be too. So all of those things play into that, and it's not easy managing all that, but it's very important that we do it, and we do it well. And I think we do. We've set up a contact book that goes out so the families can stay in close contact with each other, that I think has helped put on a nice ceremony. We give them a great lunch afterwards, and it's nice to come into that community center when the ceremony's over and watch all those survivors and those agencies and those uniformed officers all sitting around a table eating and laughing and sharing stories of their loved ones. That's kind of the high point of the day for me. I think it's an important function, and I'm certainly going to stay playing a role in it as long as they'll have me.
And my son actually has been handing out the flowers for quite a long time. I was trying to think how far back he's been doing that. It's such an impact on him when he does it, because, you know, he always tells his mother, "I feel so sad for those people," as I hand them their flowers to put in that wreath. So it's had an impact on him, except I think if we do it next year, Kevin, he'll probably be 6 foot by that time. So
yeah, he's getting big. He's, you know, I was looking at him the last time we did the ceremony, and I'm like, yeah, he's not little anymore. It's cute when he's little. Now he's getting big. But you know, it's funny you mention that, because from where I stand behind the podium there up on the memorial, as I watch that happening, you can see his face. Yeah. And it is an impact. You can see the impact it's having on him to have those families come up, and they smile, and he hands them a carnation. And this is when we call their family member's name, and then they put the carnation in the star. So you can see his reaction. It is kind of neat to watch. So, and it's really neat that you place the flower for the wounded officer who survived, and your son hands it to you. That's kind of neat too. So to have your whole family involved in it, it's nice. So, you know, it's the way I look at this is it's, you know, I can't go to that wall and look at those names without feeling a lot of wild emotional feelings due to the friends that we've lost and the shooting that we were in. So, you know, to be able to take that, all of that, and spin it into a day that you can make some good out of it and see some people have some long-term effects and get those smiles, and and see those interactions. It's worth every second of the hard work we go through all through the year to fund it. So it's all funded by donations. So we have to do fundraising. And that's a major job in itself. So to keep that going, because we're spending about $7,000 every year to put that service on, with the tents, the chairs, the dinner. We buy a lunch, we cater it. So we're spending, and I probably could knock that back, but I got to tell you, I do it kicking and screaming, because it's a big day. It has to be done right. And it costs money to do things right. So we're always looking for new ways to fundraise. So that's the biggest challenge now, is the fundraising. We started in 1886, was the first officer in New Hampshire that I have so far that was killed in the line of duty. And we're very careful how we verify that. Mm-hmm. Unlike the National Wall, we will recognize a heart attack if an officer was in a uniform. And there's one in particular that was a friend of mine, Buster Brooks, who died while on foot pursuit chasing down a suspect in Amherst. I knew Buster since I was a kid. As far as I'm concerned, that's a cause of duty. So the National doesn't recognize that. We do. And we've got them up. The last one was Steve Arkell in 2014. And hopefully, with any kind of luck, that'll be the last one I ever have to see carved in there. It's a beautiful monument. It's a great service.
Well, Colonel, I got to say thank you for what you're doing out there, because I don't know that everybody understands, as far as our listener base and the public in general, how much these ceremonies and these procedurals and these remembrances, if you will, really mean to not only the fallen officers' families, but all of us in that brotherhood and sisterhood, to grieve, to heal. And Wayne, you think about your son who has seen this in your career, and Kevin in your career, and know that this is national and represented. It's so critical we have these ceremonies, and it's so tough, like we just said, right, yes, guys, with COVID. But I can tell you right now, if we're operational next year, I want to be at that ceremony. There's nothing like that personal connection when that flower is handed off, when that flag is waved, when that salute is made. And we've all lost a lot of near and dear friends, brothers and sisters combined. And kudos to doing it, Colonel. It's real cool to hear more about it. And also for our listeners and our viewers to understand what that ceremony means, not only in New Hampshire, but what it means for the whole country. So thank you for bringing that to us.
And, you know, the best part of that memorial, while sad, the best part for me is some of the messaging that you get from the family. So as the families get to know you, they'll come up to you after the ceremony, before the ceremony, and they want to tell you their personal story. And the thing that always amazes me, and something that I try my best to not forget every day, is one thing that's very common with every one of these families is they say to me, you know, he left that morning and he gave me a kiss on the forehead, and we had plans to go out for dinner Saturday night. We were going to see the kids on Sunday. We were going to go play, you know, he's coaching soccer, so we were going to go to the soccer game on Sunday, and he just left to go to work on a normal day and never came back. And when I leave when you get done hearing those stories and you leave the ceremony, you think about that. You know, when you go home, And you have, you know, everybody fights with their wife or their significant other one, and maybe you don't take the time when you leave that morning to fix that, and you go out the door. What if you don't come back? And that's something that has always stuck in my mind. So even if she's angry when I go, I yell back in, just know I love you. I'm mad at you, but understand I love you with all my heart, because you know what? You may not come back that night, John. Right. And that's your one chance. And I'll tell you, people remember verbatim that last conversation. I have never met a family member who couldn't tell me exactly what their loved one said the very last time they talked to them, be it hanging up on a cell phone. I can tell you one instance, hanging up on a cell phone 1 hour before he was in a shootout and killed, telling angry because she hadn't had time to put the second coat on the deck floor of a new porch she had just built. But she remembered that. And we're talking 10 years ago, and she remembers that. So, you know, anyone who's listening out there, think about that, because that could happen to anybody. You get killed in a car accident. It may sound foolish to you, but to a family member, it is critical at the end that they knew that last conversation wasn't one that we all have. Take time to tell them what they mean to you, because that, you know, if that's the last time, it's going to be very important. So that's, and I hear it. I have not held a ceremony when I haven't heard a story, not once. And it's good. I like that. I like hearing the different stories, but it makes me, I leave that ceremony thinking, yeah, I got to pay attention to that because I don't want my family doing that. I want to make sure they know how much I care about them when I left in case I don't return home tonight. So it's important. It's important to remember that.
Absolutely, Kevin. It's something we need to think about day in and day out when we get right in the minutia of the stress of just life and right snapping at our spouses, our loved ones, our kids, whatever the case may be. It's carved in stone. So that's something good to pass on and something good to remind all of our officers, right?
Sure. And
say what you mean. If you're angry, delay that.
Right. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be angry.
Postpone that conversation. Hey, I love you. Thanks for your support. We'll figure this out. I got to go to work.
You put that gun on. You make sure they know what you mean to them. Yeah. You know,
especially if it, heaven forbid, it's that last conversation.
Right.
That's a very, very good point to push on. Yeah.
Absolutely. After there's a couple things that are going on, I'd like to do a moment of silence. And the colonel always reads a poem at the end of the law enforcement memorial, the New Hampshire Law Enforcement Memorial, and I'd like him to read that. And then we will hear from Game Warden Jeff Whipple, and he will tell the story of Game Warden Arnold Magoon and how he was killed in the line of duty in the state of Vermont. If we can just take some seconds here, and Colonel, and when you're ready, we'll take a moment of silence remembering all those law enforcement officers that have gave that ultimate sacrifice across this great land.
And so at the end of each service, Wayne's correct. At the end of our ceremony, I read a little thing I'm about to share with you. And I actually want to give, I don't know who the author was, I'm ashamed to say. I saw it on a monument at a veteran cemetery. My dad's a veteran, and I go to the cemetery to visit his grave on occasion. And I saw this on a monument once, and I thought it was very appropriate for the law enforcement memorial. So I use it every year, and we've done it every year for the last 10. But it reads as this. And I think these are very good words to remember. Poor is the nation that has no heroes, but shameful is the nation that has heroes and forgets them.
On today's Warden's Watch podcast, we are beginning our memorial series, very small series. We're just going to do two memorial podcasts to two game wardens that were killed in the line of duty. And I have the honor and privilege of having a game warden, Jeff Whipple, today for Warden's Watch, who is going to speak about Arnold Magoon, who was killed in the line of duty April 26, 1978, 43 years ago. And I will say I've been introduced to Arnold probably as soon as I became a game warden, as soon as I started interacting with the Vermont game wardens, because Arnold is the only game warden that's been killed in the line of duty in Vermont, which is an awesome thing, but a tragedy in itself because we never want anybody killed in the line of duty. But everything they do, Arnold Magoon's name is attached to it. Today I'm wearing a shirt that says Game Warden Field Days 2008, Arnold Magoon. These guys have honored their fallen officer like nobody else that I know. Maybe because it's only one, and you can do that, Jeff, but it is it's something to bring other game wardens from other agencies, other venues, and to remember your fallen officer and have an impact like that on them. And talking earlier about how much you guys honor, you know, Arnold in all that you do and everything, which sure, I think is very special.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a wonderful intro. And we do, right? So it's, it is our only fallen officer, and we are fortunate for that. It's every law enforcement officer's and agency's worst fear for this to happen. A felonious murder or any death in the line of duty is awful for not only for us as a warden service, but the citizens too. You know, so it's the citizens of Vermont. They're losing their local warden or their state warden, and they're also losing their friend too. And we this happened, you know, before I was born, almost 10 years before I was born. And we keep his memory alive, and with literally everything we do, from fundraiser fun times to training and all sorts of different things.
Right. And when I do this memorial podcast, I always like to take one from the past and one from closer to the present, so we don't forget the guys that were killed in the line of duty in 1978. That seems like a long time ago, Yeah, I was only age 9 at the time that this went on, but I think it's really important. And the lessons learned, again, I say this on this podcast so many times, but we take and we learn things from the incidents. Last year's Memorial podcast, we talked about the changes with Idaho after they had their murders of their officers. Vermont was no different in this case. It developed what you guys are today.
Very much so, yes. In this, learning lessons and moving forward from a tragedy has possibly, potentially saved others' lives, not just in our agency, in law enforcement across the board, in our small state, for sure. Mm.
And I'm so happy you joined me, because you shared that when you were in college, you actually did a paper on Arnold Magoon. And again, that just, it adds so much more to it. It makes it personal, and I can tell it's personal to you. So much that you went and just talked to some people that were there at the time, former lieutenant, I believe, that was actually on the force back then. You wanted to, yeah, to make sure all your facts were right. And it puts you in the mindset, Jeff. And that's one thing, especially with these memorial podcasts, I have to be in the mindset. It takes me time to put my head around the incident and to kind of delve into it. You did the same thing. I know you did. You've been thinking about this ever since we set it up, and which wasn't that long ago, but
you
actually dove into it.
Yeah. So going back to the college, so I'm a native Vermonter. I grew up in Vermont, went to school in New York, and went to school to be a game warden, and known that that's what I wanted to do. And when it came time in one of the wildlife law enforcement classes was write a paper on an incident that happened in any agency. And so I said, well, I had heard about this just, you know, from stories from, you know, game wardens when I was a kid. My dad was friends with a game warden, just talking to people. So I said, I want to really find out what happened and dive into this and write the paper on that particular night and write it from, you know, the scenario of kind of just overlooking, you know, if you were to take a sky view from it and see kind of what happened that night and moving forward on, you know, this is certainly before I was hired. But it, I don't remember what I got for a grade, but I passed the class and got a degree, and I'm here today. So,
and it may be the only report you remember that you wrote in college, too.
Very much so. Yeah, I can't quite tell you what microbiology report I wrote, but I can tell you almost word for word the paper I wrote in wildlife law enforcement for Arnold.
Yeah, and that's because you planned on being a game warden. This incident, even as a college student, was having an impact on you. And boy, like I said, all the wardens in Vermont have certainly honored Arnold's memory. And we can talk a little more about the 40-year memorial that you guys did, but maybe we should do that at the end. Maybe we should share with our listeners Arnold's story. And can we go back with Arnold? I mean, do you know what year he was came into the agency? And
yeah, I'm not sure the year that he came in, but he had been on for some time and actually worked his way up from a field warden up into a warden supervisor, so which we now call lieutenants. They were salary pay back then. He was the supervisor. He lived in Brandon, Vermont, which is in Rutland County, supervised his local guys around him.
So as Vermont goes, that's kind of more towards the west a little, central west?
Yep, in south, yeah.
Okay, yep. Central west, yep, south. I know where Rutland is, so I'm just trying to think of that
area.
Yeah,
in the town, if you know Rutland City, the town he lived in was maybe 20 minutes outside of the city, 25.
Yeah, very agricultural.
Yes.
Very rolling hills, lots of fields.
Lots of fields.
Lots of deer.
Lots of deer.
Yes.
Yeah, for the deer hunters listening.
Yeah.
So it's, and deer jacking was a thing. And so when we get into the story, that's essentially the incident that he was responding to. It happened, if we want to roll into it.
Yeah. So
it was this time of recording. Now it was this time of the year. So not a super common deer jacking time.
April. Right?
April. Yeah, and everybody, the deer are in the fields for sure, but they're coming off of winter and they're shedding, and it's just not a super common.
And I've always heard poachers say that they don't taste right this time of year because they've been eating, whether it's cedar or something else, that,
sure,
you know, a poacher that's picky about his meat doesn't usually shoot a spring deer.
Not typically. Yeah. I when I first moved to the district I'm at now, one of the first kind of locals that I met, he said, oh, you know, you're the new game warden. And he goes, well, you got here at the right time. I had moved there in June.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, they're going to be ready to fry by the 4th of July. So I'm thinking, wait, what? And then he just got in his old farm pickup and drove off. And I was like, he's talking about deer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I knew I was going to have my work cut out for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a saying they're ready to fry by the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Coming. That's when their whole system's probably switched over to that nice green grass and they're starting to taste good again.
Yeah, I guess so. maybe I'll keep a Independence Day roadkill this year and try that.
Matt. Yeah. Try that out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was the night of April 26th in 1978. Where Arnold lived, there was several fields on the way up to the house. So it was in the evening time. It was at night. He had heard, he was out, I believe he was out on his porch and heard the gunshot. So, and it was close. And he knew where fields were. And so he hops in his, fires up the 1974 Plymouth Fury and back in the rear wheel drive car.
But cruisers. That was an issued cruiser?
As an issued cruiser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was the time frame when they were probably starting to issue cruisers back in that time frame, because prior to then, that you know, they would use their own vehicles.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. So a Plymouth Fury cruiser.
Yeah. And to think about the, you know, if we complain about our trucks ever, we shouldn't. just thinking about a rear wheel drive car going up to some hunting camp somewhere.
Yeah. And I remember the wardens talking about that transition. Those first pickups were like a godsend.
Yes.
They just couldn't even believe it. And it may be, you know, rear wheel drive with one wheel turning, but they certainly appreciated the pickup truck.
Yeah. The first ones might not have had air conditioning, but they had a bed for things to throw in.
Yeah, no, I know they appreciated that. So, but lieutenants still usually drive something that you can't throw something dead in.
Yeah.
Which is a whole good thing and a bad thing. We've had that discussion. So, having driven one the end of my career, I got used to it. But I will say that first year was a learning experience trying to fit dead things into your cruiser.
Yeah. Yeah, so. And it may be the cleanup after, too, would that, be interesting.
Exactly. So the Plymouth Fury, and Furies, I don't think, had a big trunk either. That's They were a fast vehicle, I think.
They're a very fast car, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but big, not a lot of trunk room.
Right, yeah. Yeah, big bench seats, and they're fast, but that's about it.
Now, that picture, you sent me a picture of Arnold sitting in. Is that the Fury, you think?
Yes. Or,
okay, yep, that's his Fury.
Yeah.
Great. We're going to have to share that on the internet or for a cover or something, because he's sitting in behind the wheel and writing something with his Stetson on. Very iconic picture. And
it very much is, yeah.
That Fury was at, so we can connect that photo with this podcast and get some visuals.
Sure.
Oh, that's really cool.
Absolutely. So he hears the shot and jumps in the car and takes off, and immediately comes around the corner, and there's a vehicle in the field. And how many times have we've seen that? That's game warden bread and butter right there. Yep. This is what we live for.
Mm-hmm.
Shuts the car off, shuts his cruiser off, turns the lights off, hops out, and heads down into the field with no flashlight on. Comes around the corner, and at this time they have already loaded the deer. He didn't know that they had a deer at that point. They had loaded it, and they were coming out of the field. They're coming right at him, and he's standing there looking at both the headlights, shines a flashlight into the windshield, trying to identify, maybe to see who it is, and he can't see because the lights are on. The car is coming right directly at him, and then they did swerve to get around him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the interesting part that we certainly don't do in today's law enforcement, but when it was common practice back then, when a car was running from you and you were on foot, the way it was told to me was you can try and put an identification marker on the vehicle, which in simple down means use anything you can to try and smash something on the car, mm-hmm. whether it make a scratch, you put a dent in it. And so that was common practice when mm-hmm. you're trying to stop somebody on foot patrol. So Arnold steps to the left, the car whips around, he on a full one-handed swing uses the mag light to try and dent the car or knock a mirror off or something. And that mag light made contact with the glass of one of the windows and dropped it. It shattered it.
Mm.
So the car takes off and it gets back to the road and then starts speeding away. He runs back to the Plymouth, and that car was fast and he got on him quick. And when he did, it was as soon as he could see them, they started throwing evidence out. Mm. The door was open and they're throwing whatever out the passenger side of that car. And we've talked to several people that were on, and they threw everything out which is even funny to include the deer. So they had the deer somehow came out of the car. And then once they got everything thrown out, within a short distance, they pulled over.
Mm.
So they stopped. And so he hops out.
I just thought that whole visionary as you're driving down in pursuit as things are flying out, guns, lights, yeah. and there goes the deer.
And how many times, right? So how many times have you seen that the crossbow come flying out the window?
Yeah. And, yeah. And it's like, now I don't have it, I'll pull over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's maybe a sense of, I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I've never seen a deer come flying out.
But, no, I'm sure that was something to see, actually, come out of the vehicle. It was a whole deer.
What a time for cruiser cams.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Just the visual in itself, as we're talking about it, I can just see things flying. And
yeah.
So yeah. They pull over.
Yeah, so they pull over. He pulls up behind him like we'd normally do a typical traffic stop, hops out of the car and approaches. And this is an interesting point of the story. When he approaches the vehicle, he looks in and identifies there's two male subjects in there and a female. He looks at one of the young men that were in there and immediately recognizes him as one of his son's best friends or very close friend who had been at his house days before. So he thinks, he knows this guy. He knows him personally, knows the family, knows, him and his son grew up together. So he gets the three out of the vehicle like we would normally do, right? So, and then the interviews start, who shot this and that, figuring out, getting to the bottom of it, figures it out. So he goes back and they were making some headway on the incident and they, he retrieves his citation book out of the car, out of the back seat, goes to the front of his cruiser, between the headlights, has the three subjects standing. I'm not sure if they were left or right, but they were there. And one at a time, he's cutting citations.
Yeah. So and I'm thinking he's angry and disappointed if he's just...
Right. So, and you think about it's disappointment totally because it's,
Yeah.
You don't expect somebody that you're close to blatantly... It's for me, if I were to ever have that, an incident where it's one of, a family's close friend, it's kind of like a slap in the face to the board. And it's like,
That's exactly what I was thinking, Jeff. I mean, you put yourself in his shoes and the kid that was there 3 days ago. And I think of my son's, friends that are at my house and hanging out and the relationship that we have, just to be at the house and then to do something like that, I'd be angry, disappointed. And I'm sure Arnold was feeling all of that right then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
You put yourself in his shoes now that you know this person personally, I know for me, my guard is going to be let down. I know this person, they're a family friend. So,
and how many times have we just known poachers and called them by their first name?
Oh, daily basis. Exactly.
And it de-escalates on both sides when you know their first name. And usually they can take their lumps if you have a relationship with them.
Right.
I remember, some of my poachers, you got me.
Yeah.
I always really appreciated that. Yeah, I always knew you were a poacher. You know I'm the game warden when you get caught, you got me. And I appreciate that kind of poacher rather than the guy that I didn't do it.
Takes a few of those to keep the job interesting.
There's no doubt, but yeah. You're right. When you have a relationship with an individual, you let your guard down.
You totally do. I've went over this case hundreds of times and in scenarios where I've done the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. We're working through citations and he's cutting the citations and he's filling them out in the flashlight. It's not 100% determined where it exactly was. So he's got one of the big D cell mag lights. Mm-hmm. Which standard issue to most law enforcement. Everybody now carries the super bright, LED
smaller
stuff.
Ones.
Right. But the mag light is on, we believe it's on the hood of the car. So it's pointing down towards the citations. If you can create a visual, so he's using that light.
Using that light to write by because he has to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the older of the two subjects lunged, grabbed the flashlight, turned and struck him in the head very hard. Is hard enough to knock him to the ground. And Arnold was a big guy. And when he hit the ground, the subject stood over the top of him in multiple strikes to the head with the flashlight, causing skull fractures, causing unconsciousness immediately. When he was down after several strikes to the head, the three ran back to their car, jumped in their vehicle, and took off, leaving him to die on the side of the road, on the side of the road that he lives on.
Bludgeoned him to death. Brutally just kept smacking him.
Pretty personable when you think about how brutal that is. It's just that's an awful way to go. Yeah. So then when he wasn't responsive on the radio, other wardens started coming that way. Another warden out of Rutland County heard the call before, you know, when Arnold was in pursuit and started heading that way. When other wardens showed up, he was transported to the hospital and then was in the hospital overnight. And they made the final call the next morning on April 27th, 1978 is when they pronounced him deceased. Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty powerful. And you think about how many times is us out there that are listeners that are wildlife law enforcement officers, how many times have you stood by the hood of your patrol vehicle, as simple as writing even a fisherman letter license ticket, and you look and, you know, the fisherman standing there to your left, you fill out maybe his driver's license number and you look up and he's not standing there anymore. Where did he go? So it's something to keep aware of.
Right.
Absolutely. And we immediately after the incident with Arnold, some new policies went into effect. Back then, it was not uncommon for game wardens to not wear a gun belt. So the gun belt was there, and it was there that night, and it was in the back seat of the car. And it was believed that he took off so fast and rushed to the scene and wasn't wearing the gun belt.
Right.
Which was not uncommon. When I talked to the guys that worked in that era, that's what people did several times.
Yeah, and that's, like you said, that's the change, is the gun and the gun belt became part of the uniform. And if you were wearing the uniform, that was part of it.
Absolutely. And, you know, could it have prevented an incident? At the speed that the first strike happened, it would have been nearly impossible to draw and fire from the fastest person. But is the appearance a deterrent?
Right.
You know, is having at that point having a revolver, six shooter on your hip, is that a deterrent?
Yeah. Would Arnold Bullen shot to death after the first hit? And, you know,
absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, we can do those scenarios, and it's good that we do those scenarios in the aftermath.
Yeah.
To understand, like you said, to make that part of the uniform, to keep your eyes on the subjects, even when you know them very well.
And I think it's an absolute take-home message. When we train as a warden service, every time, you know, mentioning when we say we keep Arnold's memory alive, every firearms training, defensive tactics training we have, we will start the day with a moment of silence in Arnold's name and to think about that incident and really, you know, put your mindset in, okay, today is training day. This could keep me alive someday. This could, you know, whether it be scenarios or drills with all sorts of the different firearms or whatever, when you put yourself in that mindset thinking, you know, this could have been me at some point. And, you know, and maybe that saved law enforcement, maybe that saved other game wardens in our state and other law enforcement agencies as well.
Hope you certainly honor him, Vermont. I'm sure Arnold is well aware of what you guys do in his name. Like I said, from the beginning of becoming a New Hampshire warden, I was certainly familiar with Arnold Magoon's name. And every place we went, Arnold's was there. If you guys had an event, it was usually in his name. When you talk about training, to have that moment of silence, remembering him too, I think that's pretty awesome. Because again, you're putting your mindset in it. This is why we train. We lost an officer. We never want to lose another officer. So, and this is why we train. This is why we try to stay vigilant with every encounter, with every person. No, that's the ultimate sacrifice Arnold gave for the natural resources of Vermont. And, you know, certainly was willing, with like every officer, to delay his life down for a friend too, or do anything he could in the performance of his duties. And yeah, it's a tragic story. But again, it's one I want everybody to know. I want them to know Arnold Magoon, Vermont game warden, gave that ultimate sacrifice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we on the 40-year mark, which was in 2018, we had created a monument at the place that it happened. And there's a beautiful granite monument marked there at the location. We held a nice ceremony where every warden was there in our Class A parade dress uniforms. We had some retired guys speak. We had some state historians speak. It was a wonderful tribute on the 40-year mark, and here we are at 43 years. And it's a somber, pretty powerful day here at time of recording when, you know, you think about 43 years ago tonight, essentially, and it happened. And
yeah. Oh, and that's a great marker. Again, we'll put those pictures out for our listeners so they can see it, because that is a great tribute for Arnold to have that marker there. And it's pretty impressive. And, you know, game wardens through our history have had an impact. And when you said on the community, certainly that time frame, that era, those guys were so much a part of their community because communities were smaller.
Yeah.
Stop in to get a coffee. You knew almost everybody by name. He probably knew all of his poachers by name.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, so it starts to take that step up when you start losing officers when they're part of the community. It certainly has an impact. And now that monument has an impact on everybody that drives by and sees it. And I don't know how many people I see along the side road stopping to read monuments. And
yeah.
I think that's pretty cool because, as a warden, I think I read everyone in my
Absolutely.
Patrol.
Yeah. Yeah.
All those historic markers. I wanted to know what happened.
Sure.
And in the North Country here in New Hampshire, we have some that are dedicated to game wardens, which I'm pretty dang proud of.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Perry Hurlbert has one off of Route 16. Brian Abrams has one off of 302. Just the guys that had an impact on the community and on the North Country, and their communities paid tribute to them by those markers, as much as the officers that knew them and loved them for sure, and their family members. Because Arnold was a father, he was a husband, he was a community member, he was all those things. And yet, wildlife was something probably that instilled them, just like you and I.
Yeah.
It's a passion. And to help preserve that for our future generations, to be that force that fights those poachers that don't really care about our natural resources.
What more wonderful way to protect wildlife than to be on the front lines?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And unfortunately, it does come with a cost. At sometimes we train and try to prevent any future incidents. Yeah,
certainly you guys do that. You guys give Arnold a huge tribute every time you can. And you don't forget his sacrifice, which is pretty awesome, Jeff. And I'm so happy you were able to tell his story with us.
Yeah, this is wonderful. Thank you for the invite and just to spread the message out there. And you know, 1978 seems like a long time ago for especially folks that are in my age group.
Mm-hmm.
That was... you know, being in my mid-30s, it was certainly before my time, but to be able to keep the legend alive and to tell the story and to let other folks know that what happened there the night of April 26th.
Yeah. And from college to start reflecting on that till, you know, this podcast and that 40-year memorial and the so many things in the future that are going to bear Arnold's name, as I know the Vermont game wardens do. Quite a tribute. I know Arnold is very appreciative of it. So, again, thanks for joining, Jeff. We're certainly going to talk here and get a little more about Jeff Whipple, the game warden, in the future. So you'll look forward to hearing more about Jeff. So.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Wayne. It's been great.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.